Welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available 20-minute samples of recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians in social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new sample podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. In addition, you can access the full-length version of this and all NACSW podcasts at no cost simply by becoming a member of NACSW or by ordering a copy of this podcast at a reasonable cost on NACSW's online bookstore. We hope you enjoy today's sample podcast.
I'm honored to introduce our plenary speaker, the Alan Keith Lucas speaker today. I first met Trina Williams when she was a doc student at Washington University more than a decade ago. Let me tell you a little bit about her. She's currently an associate professor at the University of Michigan and a faculty associate at the Survey Research Center. Before that, she was an undergrad student in business administration. If you get a little of this history, you'll understand how she got to her topic today. So, an undergraduate degree in business administration. She was a Peace Corps volunteer in Ecuador, doing community development, I believe. And then got a master's in philosophy at Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar. That master's was in comparative social work, or social research, I'm sorry. And then subsequently got an MSW and then the PhD at Washington University in St. Louis. Her research interests include things like individual development accounts, and she's worked with promoting these in public housing, among public housing residents. Also, 529 college education plans, but for Head Start families. She's currently involved in a summer youth employment in Detroit, and so in these and other ways has done research on assets, poverty, economic development, and connections to child well-being. She's interested in public policy for families and in social and economic development, especially in urban communities. For these reasons, I'm just really proud that you're with us today, and would like the rest of you to help me welcome Katrina Trina to this class.
Okay, well, thank you, Terry, for that wonderful introduction, and thanks to Rick and all of the committee for inviting me here for this lecture today. I'm excited to be able to share some of the things that I've been doing and hopefully inspire some interesting things to be happening in congregations throughout the country. So this is a quick overview of some of the things I'm going to talk about today. Just give some basic statistics on economic inequality with an emphasis on wealth inequities, give some biblical myths and principles for stewardship of financial management, an introduction to the concept of asset building, which Terry started to talk about a little bit a few minutes ago, and then end with some suggestions on how churches might be able to improve financial capability of its members and the community. So let's see if we can get through this quickly. Overview of economic inequality. Okay, so this is just a basic chart of what has happened in income in the U.S. from 1979 until maybe 5 years ago. And if you'll see, the most gains went to the very top 1%, and then the next 20% had incomes double over this period of time, and everyone else kind of stayed flat over this period. So you can see that, at least over the last 30 years, the people at the top have been getting much higher income, and those at the bottom have stayed kind of stagnant. And if you're looking at wealth inequality, it's even worse. So this is just as a rendition to show that if 1% of the country would own about 50% of the wealth, and the top 10% would own about 90% of the wealth, and then the bottom 40% would have almost nothing, just that red little dot at the bottom. And then to show this, what this means in real dollars, the bottom fifth has zero or negative net worth. They don't have anything of value. They have more debt than they have assets. And then the top quintile has about 86 times the second quintile, about 9 times the third quintile, and about 3 times the fourth quintile. And if you look between 2000 and 2011, the top got even more, again, just like in income. If you want to see exactly how the portfolios kind of map out in the country, you can see that the top 10% are much more likely to have stocks and mutual funds and to have pension accounts. And the only place where there's almost equity in terms of the proportion of the population is for debt. So the bottom 90% has about the same amount of debt as they represent the population, but everything else in wealth, they don't. In terms of principal residence, at least some people, the people who do have money, they have it in, they have wealth in a home. And so it's a little more equal there, but you can see that the distribution of wealth and how it's concentrated, it's, at least in terms of things that are allowed to make more money over time, things like stocks and bonds, are much more likely held at the top 10% of the population. And these disparities are even worse by race. So if you look between, in this case, 1981 and 2010, blacks and blacks, non-Hispanic blacks and Latinos tend to have maybe 5 to 10 cents on the dollar as non-Hispanic white families. And then you can also see that it got worse after 2008, after the recession. So the racial wealth disparities actually got worse over the last 10 years instead of better. And this is some work I've done showing how it affects children. So if you look at children who were born in 2001, these are kids who are like 15, 16-year-old now. They live in very different circumstances depending on race. So if you look on the far end of the scale, the bluish, the cool colors, about half of white kids are in were born into families that have more than twice the poverty line and have every type of asset that was measured. So a home, money in the bank, and stocks and bonds. In contrast, if you look at Latinos, African-Americans, and American Indians, they're more likely to be in the red, so that they're less than the poverty line and they don't have assets. And so it just shows, even starting out by race, people start in very different circumstances. Here, this is a friend of mine, Mariko Chang, and she shows wealth differences by gender. And you'll see particularly that gender gaps don't exist as much in income, but are much greater in wealth. And to show this even more, you can see that for couples, men and women tend to have at least somewhat closer, but if you look at single females and single males, there's huge disparities between how much wealth is held by females and how much wealth is held by males. I'd like to stop here for a second. Has anyone heard about the Grand Challenges in Social Work? Has anybody been participating in those at all? They were announced last year at SSWR. And so if anyone is really interested in actually making a difference in these areas around economic inequality, the purpose of the Grand Challenges is to help champion social progress by science and research and to actually have a call to action to actually help tackle some of our nation's toughest problems. So in terms of the general categories, they have some challenges that deal with individual and family well-being, some challenges that deal with building a stronger social fabric, and then some that deal with building a just society that fights exclusion, marginalization, and creates a sense of well-being to promote trust and offer pathways for social and economic progress. And I actually serve as one of the co-leads for the Grand Challenge for Reducing Extreme Economic Inequality. So if you're really interested in this, I can add you to our mailing list and we can kind of talk about where we're going to go forward over the next 3 to 5 years. There's also a Grand Challenge around building financial capability for all. So at least parts of the Grand Challenges that are being taken on by the Academy of Social Work is actually around things that deal with economic inequities. But rather than talking about where we are, I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about some principles for stewardship and financial management. Before I even go into that, I'm going to talk about 10 myths. And I need to give credit. Dwight Nichols, who happens to be my father, wrote this book, God's Plan for Your Finances. So these 10 myths that I come up with are actually from his book. So, myth number one, money is the root of all evil. It's corrupt and leads people astray, so you shouldn't be concerned about money or material possessions. You might even be stealing from people if you have money, right? A thought that maybe some people might have about money. Some people say Jesus had nowhere to lay his head. Jesus was poor, had no worldly possessions. So as followers of Jesus, we should be poor as well. Matthew 19:24 talks about it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to go into heaven. So if you take that to its extreme conclusion, you can't have worldly wealth on earth and be expected to go to heaven too. In Luke 18, Luke told the young ruler to sell all his possessions and give his money away. Therefore, if you really love Jesus and want to serve God, you should take a vow of poverty, and you'll obtain your riches when you get to heaven. And some might say that preachers just want to get your money. Money's part of this world's economic system. Christians are supposed to be heavenly-minded, and therefore church should only function as a place to worship God and stay out of people's business and personal affairs. Another one, God answers prayers. Therefore, if you really trust in Jesus and exert faith, he'll meet all your financial needs. You don't have to do anything about your circumstances. Just pray, take one day at a time, and things will work out. Hebrews 13:5 says, be content with what you have. Therefore, don't worry about planning ahead. got to take care of your circumstances. Even if you're born poor on the wrong side of the tracks, there's nothing you can do about it. Just be content with where you are. And then one of the final ones, Jesus is only interested in spiritual things, not material things. Therefore, it's wrong to talk about money in church. Church is not the place for that sort of thing. And then the Deuteronomy, there's a verse that you shouldn't charge your brother interest. Therefore, if you took this to its logical conclusion, you shouldn't have any savings or investment accounts if it gives you interest. And then again, you're not supposed to lay up treasures in heaven. If you hoard money on earth, you shouldn't have surpluses or savings accounts. Having bank accounts limits your trust in God. As you probably can tell, each of these myths is actually a distorted biblical principle. So rather than saying the love of money is the root of all evil, it just says the money is the root of all evil. Rather than saying that you should never put things before God, so you should not, if you have to choose between God and mammon, you should choose God, but they're not mutually exclusive. So it's possible to be a good steward of what God has given you and not necessarily have to take a vow of poverty. And so when I start to talk about some of these things that churches can do, hopefully if you have any of these myths or ideas in your head, you can start to see that maybe churches are places where maybe some of these ideas can be discussed. So particularly if you look at Luke, Matthew, with the parable of the sower, there's a lot of biblical principles about being a good steward, about what God has given you. Rather than just burying your money and putting it in the ground, actually try to invest and try to make it grow over time. And also, the Bible talks about if you're faithful with money, then you're also probably going to be faithful with spiritual things. So just some basic principles before I start talking about asset building. So hopefully it won't seem like I'm coming out of the left field when I'm talking about these things in a Christian or a church context. So I'm going to do a slight introduction to asset building. This is some of the work that I've been doing for a while. And before I even talk about some of the projects that I'm on, I want to give just a few principles to kind of put this into some context. So this is a quote from the Roberts Foundation. The need for economic solutions to poverty is well known. You cannot escape the fact that you do not service people out of poverty. At its core, the ability to exit poverty is a question of employment, asset accumulation, and wealth creation. So you've heard if you give a person a fish, she eats for a day. If you give a teaching the person a fish, they'll eat for life. You can think of a postscript. The parable of it really matters is who owns the pond with the fish. And so the reason that I spend a lot of time thinking about this is that owning assets actually give people a stake in the future, a reason to save, to dream, to invest their time, effort, and resources in creating a future for themselves and their children. And so if you're living from day to day, don't have any economic resources, it's much harder to dream about the future, and it's much harder for your children to think their future is going to be something that's worth living. And so a friend of mine, Connie Evans, actually talks about a continuum of asset building strategies. So if you're a person who's unemployed, doesn't have any basic skills, and don't have any economic resources, and are in a household or in a community that is low income and low wealth, it's kind of hard to jump right into asset building. So she would suggest that maybe some basic adult education, actually getting a job, and then maybe you can start thinking about moving up in terms of education, and then eventually savings and financial literacy, and then maybe to the point then where you could think about the more what people really think about when they think about asset building. So starting businesses, buying a home, creating jobs. But you don't just jump from having nothing to being wealth creator, but as you take steps along the way, no matter how much money you earn, you can start saving some to get to a point where you can be better over time. But I'm going to now introduce this concept of individual development accounts that Terry talked about earlier. Actually, when I was at Washington University, my dissertation chair was Michael Sheraton, and he actually introduced this concept of individual development accounts. And his basic insight was that public policy for low-income families usually favored consumption or survival, but not really wealth creation or economic mobility. So if you give people food stamps, if you give people temporary shelter, that's great because you can survive and take care of yourself in the moment, but they're usually not things that help people get ahead. So one idea that he came up with is this idea of individual development accounts. So if an individual saves money in an individual development account, they get a match. Sometimes a match may be 2-to-1, sometimes it may be 3-to-1. So if they save $10, they'll get $30 in that individual development account. And the real twitch of this is that if you save and you get match, it has to be used for asset building purpose. So to buy a home, to get education, to start a business, sometimes for retirement, depending on the program. But the idea is that as individuals save for themselves, they get incentives and they get They get extra money to help them reach their asset building goals quicker. And the one thing that from this research that really started in the mid-80s showed that even very low-income families do save, and actually they save a higher proportion of their income often than more well-off families. And so, if you give opportunities like individual development accounts, low-income families get excited, they save, they also often get financial education to help make wise choices around home ownership and education. But it's a project that started in the 80s. Now it's funded, we'll see what happens in the next couple of years, but it has been funded through Health and Human Services, through what's called the Assets for Independence Act. And so what happens is a local organization applies to HHS, and they usually have to get a local match, but they can create these individual development accounts in their local communities. And so it went from being a research idea to public policy and to helping families throughout the country. But rather than waiting for someone to earn less than twice the poverty line, I actually spent time thinking about child development accounts. So rather than waiting until someone is earning less than twice the poverty line and really struggling economically, what happens if you start younger? What happens if you start with children? So child development accounts are actually these same kind of match savings accounts, these same sort of investment accounts, but for lifelong developmental purposes. And the original vision for Michael Sharon, at least, was to open early, ideally at birth, and if not at birth, in preschool or and kindergarten. So there's a long time horizon for compound interest. You also want it to be universal so that many, many people can have access to such accounts, and then progressive, so the most low-income families and are the ones who are going to have the highest matches and get the most incentives. So that's the idea. If you ask, where does this exist in the world? In the UK, they created something called a child trust fund where every child born in the UK got £500 in an account. Well, £250 if they're low-income, £500 to use for education or whatever purposes once they got to be 21. In Singapore, they have a really interesting set of programs. At birth, if you have match savings, it can go toward developmental purposes. So if you need to go to a doctor, if you need some sort of medical attention, if you need developmentally appropriate toys, from 0 to 5, kind of, it can be used for educational purposes, educationally appropriate purposes. And then from 5 to whenever they in secondary school, it's going to a college savings account, so it's going to be used for education purposes. And then, if they haven't used all that money in education, it goes to the Central Provident Fund, which is their equivalent of Social Security. So it's seriously a lifelong series of accounts for age-appropriate purposes. And so that doesn't exist in the U.S., but it does exist in Singapore as an example. In San Francisco, they have the kindergarten to college program. And then I've also been part of something called the SEED demonstration, which is saving for education, entrepreneurship, and down payment. And all of these programs usually have some common components. Usually there's an initial deposit of some sort. In the UK, it was £250 or £500. In Singapore, I don't know exactly how much it was, but there is an initial starting point. In San Francisco, they start with $50 from the state treasurer's coffers. And then for SEED, we started out in some places, the one that I work with at least, with $1,000 for Head Start families. So whatever that initial endowment is, it kind of gets the account started. Then you have to make a decision about account type. Some places choose bank account, just regular passbook savings accounts. But of course, in these days, they don't make much interest, so you kind of keep what you have over that period of time. And so some places have actually used the state 529 college saving plans, which usually goes into investment accounts, which means that over time, you have a chance for the money to grow at a slightly higher rate. And then you also make decisions about access. So can you use it for anything that's developmentally appropriate, that's approved by some entity? Can it only be used for college? Or then maybe can it only be used for asset building purposes like the IDA accounts? So these are the sort of decisions you make if you're creating a child development account. But the idea is you start from birth or early in life, and you help the family and the child to think over time what they want their future to be and how they're going to save and prepare for that. This is some research that comes out of the University of Kansas, Willie Elliott and his team. And what's interesting here is he shows that low-income families, even if they have very little amounts in an account in the child's name, even as little as $500, low-income children are more likely to enroll in college and then to graduate from college. So 3 times more likely to enroll in college if they have at least $500 or as little as $500 in an account in their own name, and they're 4 times more likely to graduate. So, of course, college doesn't cost $500. It usually costs a lot more. But it shows And some research I've been able to show is that usually the parent and the child start talking about these accounts, they start talking about expectations for the future, and it allows people to be more engaged in school. The program I helped start in Lansing, Michigan, we actually have activities in the school where the children bring, you know, $1.50 to deposit in their accounts or $2 to deposit in their accounts, and they have activities in school around savings, around thinking about college, around what do you want to be when you grow up. And so all those conversations that don't always happen in low-income families, or if they don't think they have the money to pay for it, these little bitty accounts at least get to the point where they start thinking about it and thinking maybe it's for them. So this is the research from University of Kansas. 3 times more likely to enroll in college, 4 times more likely to graduate, even with as little as $500 in an account.
Thank you for listening today to this 20-minute sample of NACSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. Just a reminder that you can access the full-length version of this and all NACSW podcasts at no cost by simply becoming a member of NACSW or by ordering a copy of this podcast at a reasonable cost on NACSW's online bookstore. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NACSW activities and events, including NACSW's upcoming convention in the fall, our quarterly audio conference workshops, which provide CEUs accredited by the Association of Social Work Boards, and our online continuing education program. Also, we invite you to join NACSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NACSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening in to our podcast session today.